طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we continue our coverage of the Balfour Legacy Conference, held in Cambridge on November 11th at the First Parish Church in Harvard Square. Today we feature the presentations from the first panel, titled Balfour, Israel, and Palestine. The first speech is by Professor Lawrence Davidson of Westchester University, speaking on Balfour and the Zionist Project. He is immediately followed by Professor Susan Ockram of Boston University Law School, speaking on Balfour and international law. She is followed by Thomas Suarez, author of State of Terror, How Terrorism Created Modern Israel, speaking on the role of terror in the state-building process. The panel was facilitated by Hilary Rintisi of the Middle East Project at Harvard Kennedy School of Government.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming at this early hour on a weekend, and a cold weekend for that. So I really appreciate your presence here. I want to thank the organizers as well, and especially Nancy Murray and Elaine Hagopian for their hard work, their vision, and their leadership in our community here. I'm honored to chair this panel of distinguished speakers at this very important conference. As we reflect on the consequences of the Balfour Declaration, we must recognize that the racist, colonial, and arrogant mindset that brought it about 100 years ago and allowed for the establishment of a settler colonial state on the land of Palestine dispossessed many Palestinians, including my entire family, and violently uprooted and placed them in a purgatory for the rest of their lives, whereby they were stateless, landless, and repeatedly had their history and culture erased. This same mindset continues today, as do the countless injustices suffered by the Palestinians. This is why this conference is important. This is not just a history of what happened 100 years ago, but the consequences that continue to this day. And I look forward to hearing all the various presentations we will be hearing today from different perspectives. With my brief remarks here, I will start with very brief introductions, as the bios are in the programs you have. But since this is the first panel of the conference, I ask that you help me to keep this on track, and so that we can hear everyone and have time for discussion. First, we have Lawrence Davidson, Professor Emeritus of History at Westchester University, speaking, followed by Susan Ockram, Professor of International Law at Boston University and Director of International Human Rights Clinic at Boston University, and finally, Tom Suarez, Faculty Member of Palestine's National Conservatory of Music and author of several books, and he will also be signing his book over the lunch break. So please join me in welcoming our guest panelists for this morning. Professor Davidson, if you could join me upstairs.
The title of my brief talk is Balfour and the Zionist Project. I want to begin with a series of statements. Let's imagine that Balfour is here, and we'll make a series of statements to him. And what these statements will do is affirm without hesitation that he agrees to what we're saying. Okay? So the first statement is that Britain in 1917 is an imperialist empire, and if she and her allies win in the First World War, that Britain would quickly expand its empire, particularly in the Middle East. Balfour would agree with this statement without hesitation. Second, if we asserted that the Arab and other indigenous peoples of the Middle East were less civilized and less politically capable than Europeans, who at the time were bent on slaughtering each other, but that's an aside, Balfour would agree with this, and he would say that because the non-European peoples of the Middle East were less capable, that they were right, they could rightly be put under European imperial or colonial sway. Third, if we then suggested, perhaps lowering our voice a bit here, that the wealthier elements of European Jewry exercised worldwide financial and political influence that could be used to help Britain and her allies win the war, Balfour would agree with that too. And of course, it would be based on that belief that he would make his declarative promise to support the creation of a Jewish national home in Palestine in return for Jewish wartime assistance. Then, perhaps after a solemn silence, we asserted to Balfour that the Old Testament Bible certainly held literal truths, among them the prophecy that the Jewish people would be one day returned to their promised land of Israel. Balfour would again agree with this without hesitation. And in this regard, Balfour, as well as Prime Minister Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of England at the time, would see themselves as playing a role in the fulfillment of biblical prophecy by assisting the return of the Jewish people to the modern site of ancient Israel, which was Palestine. And it should be noticed that Woodrow Wilson, the President of the United States at the time, would see himself in the same light. So we have three men of particular importance in national leadership, Prime Minister of England, the Foreign Minister of England, and the President of the United States, all who believed in biblical prophecy and saw themselves as playing a role in it. So against Balfour's dedication to the expansion of empire, his illusionary assumption of Jewish world influence, and his religious faith in the Old Testament prophecies, the fate of the Palestinian Arabs weighed very little. In fact, on August 11, 1919, Balfour wrote a memo to the Foreign Office, and in it he said, quote, "Zionism is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs and future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabited that ancient land," unquote. And just also as an aside, it's ironic, there were only two members of the war cabinet, the British war cabinet, who raised any objections to the Balfour Declaration based on consideration of the native population, Arab population in Palestine, which were then referred to as Muslimmen. Ironically, one of those was Jan Smuts of South Africa, and the other was the Jewish Lord Edwin Montague. Okay. Now, moving on, let's make a series of statements that Chaim Weizmann, who Balfour is working with at this time, and other leaders of the World Zionist Organization would agree to without hesitation. Okay? And these will be familiar, but they set up the scenario for my conclusions. One is that a Jewish state is the only plausible answer to the problem of European anti-Semitism. And since European Jews were the victims of this anti-Semitism, whatever state would be created would have to be populated and controlled by European Jews. This was the so-called Zionist project. And Chaim Weizmann, it was a complete agreement, obviously, and he was at the forefront of trying to create this and bring this project to fruition. Now, it is to be noted that the political Zionists, like Weizmann, gave almost no thought. In fact, I could find no actual reference in the documents at all to Sephardic Jews of the Near East or the significance of centuries of relative peaceful coexistence between Sephardic Jews and the Arabs. They were simply not referenced. Okay. The second statement would be that Jews of Zionist persuasion were, by 1917, agreed that Palestine, the site of ancient Israel, was the only acceptable site for such a state. And thirdly, the non-Jewish population in Palestine, native population, was of no more consequence to Zionist Jews than they were to the imperially minded British. The reason for that is because these Jews were, despite anti-Semitism, of a European mindset, and thus partook of the essentially racist view of non-Europeans at the time. In this regard, on January 19th, 1943, in a meeting with the Near East Department, subdepartment of the State Department, Chaim Weizmann stated categorically that, quote, Palestine can never be an Arab land again. And finally, Weizmann would agree with the statement that in the attempt to found a Jewish state in Palestine, an alliance with an expansionist imperial state was a reasonable tactical step. And Great Britain, rather than Germany, was the logical partner. This is because Germany was allied to the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire was, before the British came in control of Palestine. So it's to be noted that these statements, to which Balfour and Weizmann both would agree, reflected unquestioned assumptions, which in turn supported the main traits of imperialism as practiced before World War II. And these were, briefly, a sense of superiority of European civilization, a sense of possessing a superior religion, Christianity or Judaism, a racist attitude towards non-Europeans, and a willingness to ignore the rights of alleged inferiors. Now, today, most of us, particularly here, but most of us, understand that these assumptions are both factually and morally indefensible, and their consequences should be addressed and remedied. But Balfour and Weizmann were living in a time where that particular modern attitude made no sense to them at all. Nonetheless, to the extent that modern people share now this sense of moral repulsion, the world has really changed. And today we can say we live in a post-colonial era wherein imperialism is thought of as a negative thing of the past. This means that both the Balfour Declaration and the Zionist Project are really anachronisms, things of the past, much like white South Africa was. They are all products of a pre-World War II colonial era. And this leads us to another really seminal consequence. For Israel today to be truly accepted into the modern world, one of two things must happen. Either Israel must give up its racist ideology of Zionism, or the world must revert back to an acceptance of at least some of the colonial practices of the 19th century. Now, you would think that choosing the anti-racist option and therefore seriously pressuring Israel, as was done to South Africa, to fundamentally change would be the obvious choice for today's statesmen. But it's not. It's not the obvious choice for them. There is an ongoing effort, we might call it the updated Zionist project, to move the world backward so as to accept racist past practices. It constitutes an attack on international law that seeks to protect and promote human rights, despite the fact that the origin of much of that international law comes as a reaction to Nazi persecution of Jews in World War II. Doesn't matter. There is an attack on that kind of international law. And an attack on the objectivity and efficacy of the United Nations, also in the area of protection of human rights. It was war and racism that brought the two imperial entities, the British Empire and the World Zionist Organization, together. And it is war and continued justification of racism that by which Israel maintains its survival in our own day. The question for all of us is just how far we want to turn the clock back. Or essentially, we have to organize ourselves to promote the first option, which is that Israel can no longer be a Zionist state, quoted, sort of paraphrasing Weizmann, rather than the world go back to colonial practices. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to invite Professor Susan Akram to come up here.
Thank you for coming out in such a freezing cold morning. This is truly the gathering of stalwarts. And in my not-so-brief remarks, I'm afraid, I actually want to challenge the received wisdom about Balfour and discuss the question of nationality with regard to Palestinians, the claim of Jewish nationality, and compare Palestinian nationality with the claim of Jewish nationality and self-determination rights of the two peoples in the context of both peoples' territorial claims and as these are affected by Balfour, or were affected by Balfour. And it's important at the outset to define the meaning of the terms citizen and national. They're often used interchangeably, but such usage confuses their distinct legal meaning in many contexts. Moreover, nationality has a legal and a sociological meaning, and the sociological is more commonly understood than the legal. In the latter sense, nationality is taken to mean ethno-national identity, the identification with a particular group considered to have common ethnic origins, Bosnians or Serbs, Kurds, Tamils, or Armenians, regardless of the territory in which they're located. The legal meaning, however, is quite different and refers to the relationship as defined by law between an individual and a particular state or territory. Under classical international law theory, nationality determined which state a person belonged to for purposes of disputes with other states, such as for diplomatic intervention. Since nationality is, and I quote the language of the International Court, the link between the individual and international law, it is critical to determine who is a national of a state or a territory, and hence what rights in and to that territory the individual has as a matter of international law. From the legal perspective, the ethno-national identity of a person is irrelevant, as it is the connection the person has to a particular state or territory, that is, his membership in it, which defines his legal nationality. The term citizen is mostly of significance as a matter of the domestic law of states, that is, a state can determine through its internal laws which among its residents have the preferred status of citizenship, with the particular privileges and benefits afforded by that status. Although in classical international law terms the nationality of a person is determined vis-a-vis international law and citizenship by domestic law, the distinction between the two has become less significant with growing importance, the growing importance of human rights law. In the Palestine case, however, and indeed in most of the Arab world, the distinction between the two remains both relevant and critical. So I'll start with Palestinian nationality. The argument that Palestinians have a recognized nationality begins with the Ottoman Empire. Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire from 1516 until 1923. Various changes occurred to the territory, none of which are really important to our nationality question, until the Treaty of Lausanne on 24 July 1923. On 6 August 1924, under the terms of the Lausanne Treaty, Ottoman citizens who resided in the territory of Palestine became Palestinian citizens. As a matter of international law, Palestinian nationality was formed on this date. The Lausanne Treaty also created separate territories, fixed borders, and established separate nationalities for Transjordan, Egypt, Syria, and Lebanon. Following the Lausanne Treaty, each of these territories, including Palestine, had a citizenship law that codified their nationality status. Under British mandate, during the League of Nations period from 1922 until 1948, Palestinian citizenship was codified by British law, the Palestinian Citizenship Order of 1925, which included the acquisition of Palestinian citizenship through birth in Palestine, primarily. Under the mandate system, the local people were not nationals of the mandate powers, although they could obtain diplomatic protection from the mandate country. The Palestine Citizenship Order afforded Palestinian citizenship to all those who were Turkish subjects or citizens at the time of the Lausanne Treaty and were habitually resident in Palestine. The population meeting this criteria numbered 847,000 people. These included, however, certain foreign residents who immigrated to Palestine between 1920 and 1922, mostly immigrant Jews. By proclamation of September 1922, the British government provided that any person of other than Ottoman nationality, habitually resident in Palestine on that date, might apply for Palestinian citizenship. Approximately 38,000 people were granted Palestine citizenship under that proclamation, mostly Jews. Thus far, aside from the complication of the British mandate itself and the inclusion of the terms of the Balfour Declaration in it, which I'll come to later, the recognition and codification of Palestinian nationality was consistent with international law. It attached to a population that was genuinely and intrinsically linked to a defined territory with specified borders and was passed through blood, residence, or birth on the territory. It was also consistent with the customary law rule that inhabitants found on a territory when there's a change of sovereignty should automatically acquire the nationality of the successor state. The British citizenship law, even granting status to immigrants, was generally consistent with these rules. Under the British citizenship law, Palestinians could obtain passports, and over 70,000 Palestinian passports were issued. So now we come to the Balfour Declaration and what it had to do with the nationality question. By 1901, the World Zionist Organization had established the Jewish National Fund to purchase land for Jewish settlers in Palestine, as well as in other areas in the Middle East and Africa. Theodor Herzl and the WZO envisioned the Zionist project of redeeming the land for Jews as taking land from the Arabs and expelling them from Palestine. The Zionists succeeded, as you heard from Lawrence Davidson, in aligning their plan with British interests in the Middle East. And in 1917, the British cabinet endorsed the letter that became known as the Balfour Declaration. Leila Farsak read the letter. I won't read it again, but simply to point out a few issues about it. The Zionists interpreted the endorsement of the Declaration of Balfour as a British commitment to the Jewish people for the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. First, Britain had no legal authority to create any political entity in Palestine that disregarded the rights of the indigenous Palestinian population, a fact that's actually recognized in the declaration itself. Second, such an interpretation violated the agreement made between the British government and Arab leaders during World War I that guaranteed the independence of the Arabs in all the regions under authority of the Sharif of Mecca once the war had ended, that indisputably included Palestine, as even the British Foreign Office maps showed. Third, there was no legal concept of the Jewish people as a political entity with recognized rights separate from the religious or cultural identity of the Jewish people. Fourth, the history of the Balfour Declaration reflects that the British government itself did not believe that the Zionists represented the rights or interests of the Jewish people. Anti-Zionist Jews, particularly prominent political leaders such as Lord Montague, made it clear to the British government that the Zionists did not represent British Jews, let alone world Jewry. Most important, the British Parliament neither endorsed the Balfour Declaration nor passed it. It was defeated in both houses when put to a parliamentary vote. The only consistent interpretation of the Balfour Declaration with the negotiations and drafting history, Britain's pre-existing obligations under the League of Nations Charter, the mandate and its provision on minority treaties, and with existing international law was that Britain intended to provide for Jews a home in Palestine, but not a homeland, not a Jewish state. In other words, Britain recognized repeatedly in government letters, statements, and actions that it intended to provide a sanctuary for Jews in Palestine without violating the rights of Palestinian Arabs or the rights of Jews in any other country in the world. Nothing in the historical or legal history gives support for a claim that the Balfour Declaration recognized Jewish nationality attached to a distinct population of individuals entitled to self-determination in Palestine. Next, we come to Resolution 181 and the nationality question. This is the next major legal historical development relevant to the question of nationality, and that is Resolution 181, the partition plan of 29 November 1947. First, it's important to note that 181 was a General Assembly resolution, not a Security Council resolution. And under the UN Charter, the General Assembly has no authority to divide territory or to enforce any kind of obligation on states or people. The resolution language itself begins with the General Assembly recommends. The United Nations as a whole recognized this, as after passage of 181, both the Security Council and Britain, the mandatory power, refused to enforce the partition plan. The UN Secretariat issued an interpretation stating that Resolution 181 has no obligatory character whatsoever. The attempt to take the issue of the legality of 181 to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion was narrowly defeated by states strong-armed by the U.S. and Israel to defeat the effort. Second, it's important to understand the actual provisions of 181. In terms of nationalities, it is true that the British had separated Jewish from Arab nationalities in Palestine in incorporating the Balfour Declaration into the mandate and in granting citizenship to Jews who had entered and remained illegally. Still, the Jews given citizenship were those actually residing in Palestine, not outside. 181's recognition of a Jewish and an Arab state did refer to religious and racial criteria to identify territorial division, but referred to them as the two peoples of Palestine. The plan stated that Palestinian citizens residing in Palestine, as well as the Arabs and Jews, who, not holding Palestinian citizenship, reside in Palestine, shall, upon the recognition of independence, become citizens of the state in which they are resident and enjoy full civil and political rights. This requires careful note. The plan's principle was that Palestinian citizens, regardless of their religion, residing in the Arab state, would become citizens of the Arab state. Palestinian citizens residing in the Jewish state, regardless of their religion, would become citizens of the Jewish state. Moreover, the population demographics on which the partition plan was based were incorrect because they excluded the Arab Bedouins. The British Palestine authorities telegrammed the serious omission to the British Foreign Office upon release of the plan for partition. It's important enough to quote. It said, "The immediately striking feature of the plan is that on the committee's own figures, including 90,000 Bedouins, the Jewish state would contain more Arabs than Jews. The Arab population is larger than any the plan has seriously propounded." Finally, the resolution required a one-year period prior to recognition of independence of either state, during which time both states had to incorporate constitutions that provided for equal rights for all citizens with no discrimination. Thus, the partition plan did not authorize either state to institutionalize superior rights for any religious or racial group. Aside from recommending partition of territory that was not within its authority, the General Assembly's plan of how division was to be made, that is, on the basis of habitual residents and citizens already on each territory, was on its terms consistent with international law. It preserved Palestinian nationality stemming from the Lausanne Treaty and the British citizenship laws of Palestine. Nothing in Resolution 181 gives support for a claim of Jewish nationality other than those Jews habitually resident in Palestine, eligible for Palestinian citizenship living on the territory. There are several other documents I don't really have time to go through. Resolution 194 has something to say about the nationality issue and Israeli citizenship nationality law. But let me end with talking about the Jewish claims of nationality. Is there a Jewish nationality? Israel granted two-tiered citizenship under its nationality law after it became a state. But that must also be scrutinized for conformance with international law. Israeli nationality law created a legal fiction. There's no such thing as Israeli nationality, as the Israeli High Court itself has confirmed. Israeli law, official institutions, or records do not recognize an Israeli nationality status. Israel's Interior Ministry lists over 100 nationalities. No Israeli nationality is listed. The only nationality to which rights and privileges are attached is Jewish nationality. Jewish claims of nationality and self-determination must be clearly distinguished from the claims of Israeli Jews to nationality and self-determination as a matter of international law. Israel proclaimed her state on behalf of the Jewish people, a concept which, until today, grants rights to and within the state on an extraterritorial basis. When it enacted its citizenship law in 1950, it granted nationality, as I said, to Jews only, repealing the Palestine citizenship law passed by Britain. The people entitled to national status in the Jewish state, defined under the partition resolution, included both Jews and Palestinians already residing in the territory, all of whom were to be granted equal rights under a constitution to be enforced in both states prior to UN recognition. So what is the status of Palestinian nationality today, and what relevance does it have to our question? On the one hand, there's an argument that Palestinians continue to retain Palestinian nationality to the present. This is based on the historical and legal facts I've described. and that Israel's revocation of Palestinian citizenship and denaturalization of Palestinians was illegal, and its denial of Palestinian return is also illegal. The argument rests on the claim that Israel's acts being illegal do not affect Palestinian nationality as a matter of international law, and that that nationality remains unbroken despite the inability of the majority of Palestinians to return to their homes. And I'll end with the argument that Palestinians lost their nationality in 1948 and those unable to meet the criteria of Israel's law of nationality having become stateless. My contention is that this is a weaker argument, both legally and in terms of its consequences for Palestinians and Palestinian refugees, in particular with regard to the right of return. In the Western states, this is marginally helpful, that is, designating Palestinians as stateless, because there have been no advantages to Palestinians from that definition. It's my contention that Palestinians have been right in maintaining that their Palestinian nationality remains intact today, that they are not stateless, and their right of return is based squarely on their rights as nationals of Palestine, not just as refugees. Moreover, there's no parallel legal authority, whether in the Balfour Declaration, in 181, in 194, or any subsequent resolutions, for a claim of Jewish nationality that negates Palestine national rights. Advocacy on right of return for Palestinians as nationals, not as stateless persons, and not just as refugees, should be clearly framed around the language and principles underlying Resolution 181, Resolution 194, and the illegality of Israel's so-called nationality law. Thank you.
I'd like to invite our last speaker, Tom Suarez, to come up.
Quickly, I'd like to mention an extremely important book, Palestine, the Reality, which was written by a journalist at the time, published in 1940. Most copies were destroyed in the German Blitz. It has now been newly republished and is available here, thanks to Interlink Books. The Balfour Declaration unleashed a campaign of Zionist terrorism that is shockingly at odds with the prevailing narrative of Israel's birth, and more to the point, the very nature of Zionism. This history is not in question. It is preserved in British source documents, in mainstream media of the day, and in Zionist records. Today's tragedy in Israel-Palestine cannot be detached from this history of terrorism because the so-called conflict is that ongoing history. Balfour's legacy typically conjures images of the dispossession of non-Jewish Palestinians. Missing from this snapshot is the parallel violence against Jews that Balfour's signature set loose. Like its violence against the Palestinians, Zionism's anti-Jewish violence took two forms: physical violence and dehumanization, what one might call spiritual violence. For both peoples, the physical violence was to force mass human migration, just as Palestinians could not be removed from the land except by violence against them. Zionism could not install a critical mass of Jews in their place without violence against Jews. For Palestinians, this was ethnic cleansing and massacres, as well as starving them off the land by expropriating all means of livelihood. For Jews, the violence was more camouflaged. Its principal forms were the blocking of any safe haven outside of Palestine, manufactured violence to force the uprooting of Jews living elsewhere in peace, and the indoctrination of Jewish DPs, displaced people, and children into Zionist messianic fundamentalism. But all this is violence against civilians to force a political goal. That is to say, the Zionist project itself is by its very nature one of terrorism. And so Zionism needed two antidotes. One, it needed to reframe its terrorism as defense, which it accomplished by dehumanizing the Palestinians, the obstacle to its settler state, into an eternal threat, irredeemably violent as a race. And two, it needed extraordinary impunity for which it dehumanized Jews, the means to its settler state. Zionism achieved this impunity by dehumanizing Jews into the settler state itself. Israel acts as the very embodiment of Jews, Jewish history, culture, and persecution, expropriating these and all they symbolize back to the Jewish kingdoms cited in the Old Testament, of which it claims to be the rebirth. And it reinforces this messianic facade by expropriating relevant archaeological artifacts as artifacts of the nation state's history. In closed discussions, Ben-Gurion made no pretense about the cynicism of this. The reason they would call their state Israel, he said, was to get Jews to go there. It was brilliant marketing, and the military value of this is staggering, reducing Jewry to a human shield for the settler state and enabling Israel to frame criticism of it as criticism of Jews themselves, thus making criticism anti-Semitic by definition. But inescapably, this means that all Jews, simply because they are Jews, are then guilty of whatever the Israeli state does. Thus, Zionism, if we accept it, succeeds where all the bigots through the centuries never could. If we accept it, Zionism corrupts Jewry itself from within. And so the oft-heard question, does anti-Zionism necessarily equal anti-Semitism, is backwards. The question should be, is Zionism necessarily anti-Semitic? The Zionist cause was always held sacrosanct above all else, even during World War II, and even when it frustrated the Allies' war efforts. And with the Allied victory, Zionism continued to claim its tribal, extranational ownership over the war's Jewish survivors. It did not matter what, given the honest opportunity, the survivors might have wished for themselves as their individual self-determination. They were segregated from non-Jewish survivors and put into Zionist-run camps that were nothing short of indoctrination factories, tolerating no deviance from Zionist orthodoxy. Opportunities for hundreds of thousands of new homes in safe countries, like the United States and Britain, were sabotaged by Zionist leaders who needed the DPs to populate their settler state. A kidnapping campaign was waged to remove children of Jewish background from their adoptive European families because Zionism needed the children as facts on the ground. European Jewish children still in the camps were blocked from new homes, even new Jewish homes, if those homes were not in Palestine. Propaganda events, most famously the vessel Exodus, were staged at the expense of the welfare of Jewish survivors who were turned into sympathy victims and then forgotten once the theater was over. Jewish communities in the Middle East and North Africa were subjected to scare propaganda and false flag terrorism to ethnically cleanse Jews from their homelands to become second-class ethnic fodder in Israel. And when, in the 1980s, Jews were able to leave Russia and emigrate to the United States, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, former bigwig of the terror gang Lehi, successfully coerced U.S. President Reagan to close U.S. doors to them. It is consummate irony, then, that Zionism is now being flaunted as Jewish self-determination. It is exactly the opposite. It is the hijacking of that individual self-identity and self-determination, and the hijacking of that individual self-identity and self-determination by a political project that has been the cause of a century of misery, displacement, and death. Balfour and the other officials responsible knew in 1917, knew all along that the declaration's polite phrase about no harm coming to the Palestinians was a lie. It was never a failure of good intentions. And as the years passed, the determination to seize and ethnically cleanse Palestine remained the explicit plan of the top Zionist leaders, Ben-Gurion, Weizmann, etc. Balfour lived long enough to see his signature translate into Zionist anti-Jewish violence. By 1924, the allegedly defensive Haganah, what would become the Israeli military, was already assassinating Jews for their opposition to Zionism. But Balfour did not live quite long enough to lose hope that the Zionists would double as surrogate empire builders for Britain. Rather, Zionist terrorism continued through World War II and by 1946 was tearing Palestine apart as the Palestinians maintained stoic nonviolence. Anyone or anything that kept Palestine a functioning society was a target of the Zionists. Trains, roads, bridges, communications, oil facilities, and Coast Guard stations were constantly being bombed. Soldiers, utility workers, telephone repairmen, railway workers, bomb disposal personnel, anyone coming forward to help stop the terror were murdered. Police, and especially Jewish police, were long a favorite target of the Zionists and were gunned down by the dozens. That Jewish children were indoctrinated and exploited was obvious at least as early as 1938, when the British caught the bomber of a Palestinian bus. She was 12 years old, egged on by three adults. Teenagers were commonly used for terror attacks, and those who resisted involvement in the militias were blocked from advancement in school. Among the smaller terror organizations that popped up was one specifically dedicated to preventing Jews from befriending non-Jews, the ultimate fear, of course, being polluting what for the Zionists was the pure Jewish race. As a sample of its methods, the terror group doused a disobedient Jewish girl with acid, severely injuring her and blinding her in one eye. Illustrative of the degree to which Zionist plans infiltrated the government in everyday life, a couple of months after one Coast Guard station was attacked and bombed by the Haganah, it blew up again, but the British were baffled because this time there had been no attack. It just blew up. They discovered that the construction crew that had rebuilt the station after the previous attack were Haganah and had simply embedded explosives in the reconstruction. But the worst problem of infiltration was in the military service, where deadly sabotage by Zionist plans who had joined the forces led, tragically, to orders to remove all Jews from service in Palestine because there was no way to tell them from the Zionists. By 1948, this problem spread to key medical personnel. After the Jewish agency poisoned the water supply of Acre with typhoid in order to expedite the ethnic cleansing of the city that lies on the Palestinian side of partition, the bacteriologist hired by the British proved to be a Haganah plant or sympathizer, an obstacle to the availability of the vaccine. Nor did Balfour live long enough to see his signature spread terrorism to Europe and Britain. His own embassy in Rome, bombed. Allied trains in Austria, bombed. Government buildings in London, bombed. And a concerted, though almost entirely unsuccessful, campaign of letter bombs. 30 years and 27 days after Balfour signed his name, the UN capitulated to Zionist terrorism and passed UN Resolution 181 with its implicit creation of the Israeli state. The alternate UN plan was for a binational state, but this compromise would be, to quote British documents, totally unacceptable to the Zionists and, quote, would therefore be followed by an intensification of Jewish terrorism. That is, yet greater terrorism over that which had already brought Palestine to its knees. The disproportionately large land area the UN gave the Zionists in Resolution 181 was also a capitulation to Zionist terrorism. Again, quoting British sources, giving the Zionists so much land up front was an attempt to delay, not prevent, but merely delay the Zionist expansionist wars that they knew would come. But this appeasement, of course, failed because within a few months of Resolution 181, the Zionist militias were already waging their first expansionist war, confiscating more than half of the Palestinian side of partition. In the words of the High Commissioner at the time, the Zionists were jubilant with their campaign of calculated aggression coupled with brutality, the mortaring of terrified women and children. And the Zionist persecution of Jews who displeased them has, quote, reached medieval standards. The armistice that ended the 1948 war established a ceasefire line, essentially what would become known as the 67 borders, that, to quote from the agreement, is not to be construed in any sense as a political or territorial boundary. Israel was supposed to return to the agreed partition or other mutually agreed alternative, but it simply refused. Even if one accepts the legality of partition, the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land began then, in 1948, not in 1967. Fast forward to today, and what is the living legacy of Britain's arrogance in giving away other people's land? Generations of people are condemned to life in camps because they are the wrong ethnicity. People live under a ruthless military occupation because they are the wrong ethnicity. And Gaza has been reduced to a laboratory for sadism and weapons proving. Were Balfour to be alive today, perhaps what for him would be the greatest irony is how his living declaration now corrupts British politics and censors speech and debate in Britain on behalf of the foreign state his signature helped jumpstart. The conflict could end tomorrow if the complicit nations, the United States, Britain, and the various European countries, stop enabling it. And lest this claim seem exaggerated, just imagine for a moment how the international community would react if the ethnicities in this so-called conflict were reversed. If the ethnicities were reversed, the international community would rush their militaries to the region to stop precisely what it now empowers and finances. It would suddenly demand an immediate end to race laws and apartheid and the creation of a secular democratic state of equals. And the international community would jump to proclaim that equality, obviously, means the unqualified right of return. It would suddenly be self-evident that you can't ethnically cleanse people and then say that equality does not apply to them because they're not present. The British government's refusal to acknowledge the sins of its predecessors is disgraceful, but it is the United States that since the mid-1940s has been the principal torchbearer of the Balfour Declaration, and so as Americans, it is our moral responsibility to make it history. Thank you.
You have been listening to Lawrence Davidson, Susan Ockram, and Thomas Suarez speaking at the conference on Balfour's legacy, confronting the consequences, held in Cambridge, Massachusetts on November 11th of 2017. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will continue our coverage of the Balfour Legacy Conference. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.